You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station. The bigger picture on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, I'm Shazmin Shamsuddin, and if you don't know what you want to be, well, a psychology degree could be useful because it provides relevant expertise and transferable skills for several career paths. Now, a career in psychology can give an insight into what makes people tick and the responsibility to help them make sense of it. The good news is career opportunities in the field of psychology is expected to grow in the next decade. And to talk to us about pursuing a career in psychology is Peter Mitchell, the editor-in-chief of the British Journal of Psychology. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks very much for inviting me.
You're welcome. Now, Peter, before we begin, could you clarify the difference between psychology and psychiatry?
Psychology is much broader than psychiatry. Psychiatry is concerned just with psychological disorders, whereas psychology is concerned with all aspects of psychological and mental performance, emotional performance. It's concerned with all aspects of human ability, whereas psychiatry is just concerned with medical matters.
Right. Okay. You yourself, you're a qualified psychologist.
My degrees are at Liverpool University, where I did BA in psychology and PhD, specializing in developmental disorders.
Okay. Why did you decide to pursue a career in psychology?
Like most people who are interested in psychology, I wanted to help people. I was quite fascinated by what makes people tick, indeed what makes myself tick. And I wanted to help people who perhaps were in need, people who had psychological disorders, people who perhaps could perform a little bit better in life, have a more satisfying life, more successful career. And that's the kind of thing that interested me in psychology.
Okay. Did you practice as a psychologist?
Well, as I said, my specialism is in developmental disorders, especially in the area of autism. Autism, I don't know if you know, but autism is occurring at about a rate of 1 in 100 in the population. And the way this is diagnosed internationally is by the Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule, ADOS. And at the present time, this is something that's not widely used in Malaysia. So one way in which I'm practicing at the moment is to establish a widespread diagnostic program in Malaysia. And we're gaining help from a charity called the Tinggi Foundation, who are giving us some funds to do this. And we're also working in collaboration with NASOM, the National Autism Society of Malaysia. We're going to train some doctors, some practitioners to be able to use the ADOS, and then we'll get some idea of the scale of this problem in Malaysia. So that's the way in which I'm practicing psychology at the present time.
Okay, so you're not seeing clients on a couch and
that's not my specialism.
Psychoanalyzing them.
That's not my specialism. Right. My area is actually experimental psychology.
Right.
And so my approach would be in terms of using systematic tests, objective assessment, not so much counseling or psychoanalysis.
Right.
That's something I don't really know about.
Why do a lot of people have that image when you mention a career in psychology? They always think, oh, you know, to be someone that another person comes to for advice or to moan about their problems and their issues and to try to fix them.
For various reasons. Of course, traditionally, psychology is heavily influenced by, or was heavily influenced by, Freud and various other psychoanalysts. And then recently in popular TV programs like Frasier or various movies that we might see, American movies especially, the image that's presented of a psychologist is someone who's actually doing psychoanalysis or doing counseling. But my approach to psychology, my training in psychology, is more of a systematic approach based on objective observation and using the tools of cognitive neuroscience, which I'll be happy to talk more about later.
Right. Okay. Now, there are many areas of psychology, as you mentioned, that one could study in practice. For example, there are areas of health psychology, education, forensic, and criminal psychology. In Malaysia, most of us are aware of clinical psychologists. Could you tell us more about these other areas of psychology, which are interesting and have prospects as well?
With pleasure, but perhaps first I could just go a bit further to dispel some myths about clinical psychology.
Sure.
Clinical psychology, somebody who's practicing as a clinical psychologist, especially in the UK, is somebody who will have done a BSc in psychology, and then they will do a postgraduate degree, giving them a doctorate in clinical psychology. And that person then would be entitled to work in the National Health Service. They'd be working alongside other doctors. They'd have the title of doctor. They'd work alongside other doctors. And they'd have a huge responsibility. They'd be involved in assessment, in diagnosis. They'd be involved in designing programs of intervention for people with psychological disorders. And they'd also be prescribing medication as appropriate. So they have all the responsibilities that you would expect of a hospital doctor. And, of course, what goes with that big responsibility is a big salary. And clinical psychologists in the UK would start with the equivalent of approximately 200,000 ringgits a year, and then they could expect to make progress in their career to a point where they might be earning something like 500,000 ringgits a year.
Wow.
So doctors in the UK and various other countries like this have a big responsibility. They have a very serious career, and they're very well rewarded.
Okay, so how long is the, you know, the journey to that, I guess, that salary scale? I mean, from your education, how long normally do psychologists study?
In the UK, you'd start with a BSc in psychology, as I said. Mm-hmm. Then
that's a three-year program.
That's
usually
a three-year program, and then in order to be eligible to go on to the clinical doctorate course, you would probably need some clinical experience first. And having graduated from a BSc, many people then go on to work as a hospital technician for a while, perhaps as a psychologist assistant or as a technician. And that would involve administering various psychological tests under the supervision of a professional psychologist. And having gained perhaps 1 or 2 years' experience, they would then look like a very strong candidate to enter onto a clinical doctorate program. And that would be a further 3 years' training. In many cases, students, while they're doing the doctorate, are actually receiving a salary as well. And having graduated with a doctorate, it's then very, very easy to get a job in the National Health Service because psychologists are in high demand. The starting salary, as I said, you would expect to be about 200,000 ringgits per year.
Right.
The prospects of promotion are very, very considerable. You'd expect to be promoted very rapidly.
Why is that?
The reason is because this is a growing profession, and people recognize in the UK and lots of other countries that we need psychologists. There are many people with psychological problems that we perhaps didn't recognize in the past. Let me give you a case in point. As I said, autism occurs at the rate of about 1 per 100 in the population in the UK. That means that there's about 500,000 people in the UK who have autism. In Malaysia, there's probably 250,000 people who have autism. Now, in the UK, this epidemic of autism is becoming more widely recognized, whereas in the past there was still the same number of people with autism, but parents and family members felt embarrassed about it and they tried to hide it, and so those kids weren't receiving a good education, they weren't being helped, and they were just being hidden away. Whereas now there's a growing recognition that we have to do something about this problem. We have to do something about this disorder. And so we need professionals who can help these individuals. And that is why, I mean, that's one example of why the psychology service is growing in the UK.
Okay.
Now, I think the same is going to happen in Malaysia, because I think there are many instances of people with psychological problems who are going to need help, who currently are being hidden away. But in the future, it'll be different.
Okay. I was about to ask you about the Malaysian context in all of this. All right, let's move on to the areas of education, forensic and criminal psychology. Could you tell us, about these areas? They seem quite interesting, but we don't have a lot of information about.
Absolutely. Well, one area that you missed out was sports psychology.
Sports psychology, which I think is quite an interesting one.
In the Beijing Games, for example, the athletes there who are winning gold medals, they're being supported and they're being helped by sports psychologists. Now, of course, you might ask, why is a sports psychologist needed and exactly what are they doing? And now, I don't know if you watched, for example, the women's final of the of the French Open. Did you by any chance watch
No,
that?
I didn't.
So that was against Stosa from Australia, against Schiavone from Italy. Now, if you ask yourself, you know, who's the best player here, the answer is clearly Stosa. Absolutely no question about it. She's somebody who's fitter, stronger, has better technique, is a younger person, and yet somehow she was beaten easily by Schiavone. Why? Because Schiavone had the right mind. Stosa didn't. And when Stosa went to the net a few times to take some volleys, she was a bit nervous and she made a mistake. And after that, she played more cautiously. And then Schiavone could easily play those cautious shots and she went on to win quite easily. So a sports psychologist is somebody who can work with the athlete or can work with a sports professional to get them to have the right mind, to get them to have the right approach to training, and then that's what's going to make them into a champion. Now, I don't know if you're by any chance interested in the British Premier League.
No, but I do watch Footballers' Wives on occasion.
Oh, really? Well, that's one I've not watched, actually. But, I mean, if you look at the difference between someone like David Beckham and Wayne Rooney, Beckham has terrific technique at crossing the ball into the penalty area. You know, nobody could deny that. He's the best crosser in the world. But if you look at somebody like Wayne Rooney, he can't do that. But what he can do is he has a magnificent brain and he has a great intuitive understanding of his teammates. And that is what makes him into a great player. Beckham doesn't have that. Mm-hmm. Rooney is the better psychologist. Now, if you what you need to make a especially a football team really successful is a sports psychologist who can work with the players and help them to understand each other's minds, mm-hmm. and then they're going to be a winning team.
Wonderful. How much does a sports psychologist earn? Works within the EPL.
I don't know the answer to that question, but given the amount of money that's involved in Premier Football, I should imagine a huge amount of money.
Wonderful stuff. Today we are talking about pursuing a career in psychology. The scope is endless. We're speaking to Peter Mitchell, the editor-in-chief of the British Journal of Psychology. We'll find out a little bit more right after this.
You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station.
And good afternoon. It is a lovely Monday. And to talk to us today about pursuing a career in psychology, we have Peter Mitchell, the editor-in-chief of the British Journal of Psychology. Now, we touched on sports psychology. It sounds like a fascinating career, especially for, you know, students, Malaysian students of psychology who perhaps up to this point were only looking at a career in clinical psychology. But there were others that I mentioned earlier, education psychology, forensic psychology, even criminal psychology. Could you briefly touch on that, Peter?
Yeah, with pleasure. An educational psychologist is somebody who's working, certainly in the UK anyway, is working for the local education authority, is working quite closely with school teachers. And when a child is identified in the school who's having serious educational difficulties, then the teacher might refer this case to an educational psychologist. Now, an educational psychologist in the UK is somebody who would have done a BSc in psychology, then they would have worked for perhaps at least 2 years as a teacher in a school, so they'd need to have had a teaching qualification as well, and then they go on to do a 3-year doctorate in educational psychology, and then they have the title doctor. The teacher will refer to the educational psychologist. The educational psychologist will assess the child and will design a program of study that's going to suit that child's needs. They'll create an individual educational plan for this child. Now, in the process, the educational psychologist might observe that the child has something that's more of a clinical disorder, like, for example, autism or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, in which case he or she would then refer that to a clinical psychologist who would treat the child in a clinical setting.
So most educational psychologists would be working within the school system, is
they
that
would
right?
indeed, yeah.
Okay. What does a forensic psychologist do?
If you want to be a forensic psychologist, having completed your BSc, you would then go on to do a master's degree in forensic psychology, or I think some universities offer even a doctorate in forensic psychology. You would be working with the criminal service, you'd be working with the police force, and one of your tasks would be to create a profile of somebody who might be on the run. So you know that somebody's committed some crimes, they might be quite horrendous crimes. Mm-hmm. They're obviously very, very dangerous to the community. And the police are assembling evidence to try to find this person. They will use physical evidence, but they also want psychological evidence that can give you an idea of what this person might be planning, what this person is going to do next. And this is the kind of advice and information that can be provided by a forensic psychologist. So for me, I would regard a forensic psychologist and a criminal psychologist, they're the same thing.
They're the same thing. Yeah. Wonderful. Now, if you were to pursue a degree in psychology, what would you have to look out for in terms of course content, lecturers, and the institution itself?
I think this is the really critical question. And my opinion here is that you'd want the course that's being offered to be research-led. In other words, you would want the people who are teaching you themselves to be active researchers, people who are publishing books, people who are publishing research articles, because in that case, you're teaching, what you're hearing from your lecturers is authoritative.
Cutting edge as well.
It's cutting edge. You're hearing it from the horse's mouth, so that's definitely one thing I'd look for. Another thing I'd look for is the particular kind of topics that are covered by the degree. So, and that's going to depend on your own preference. If you see yourself as eventually being a counseling psychologist, you might wish to concentrate, obviously, on a degree that focuses on areas relevant to counseling. But if you want to do something that's more technical or something that's more scientific, then you might look for a degree that has quite a large content of cognitive neuroscience, that's using the techniques and the technology of cognitive neuroscience. For example, electrophysiology, EEG, eye tracking, these kinds of techniques. So as a parent or a student, I would want to know if the college has those kinds of facilities and has those kinds of expertise. These are really critical technologies for the future of our society. So I'd want to know if my child was going to be trained with those techniques.
Okay. Are all psychologists recognized by Malaysia's Ministry of Health?
I would say not at the present time, because at the present time, there isn't actually a charter of psychologists in Malaysia, as far as I know. I could be wrong, but as far as I know, there is not a charter. But what I do know is that the heads of psychology departments in Malaysia are trying to form an association to establish a charter. And once that's done, then indeed it should be the case that psychologists are recognized by the ministry.
Right. So would you have to serve in government like other medical doctors? I guess it would depend on your special area of specialization, wouldn't it?
It does depend on your area of specialization, but certainly it's the case that many psychologists are informing government. If I might give a case in point, my friend and colleague, Professor Jeff Underwood, who incidentally visited Malaysia to give a lecture last year, he's going to visit again later this year, in fact, is a specialist in road accidents, and he's using various kinds of neuroscience technology to investigate what kind of mistakes people are making when road accidents happen. And he's been on a panel advising the UK government what we can do to help to avoid accidents. And in consequence, in recognition of this, the driving test in the UK has actually been changed to take on some evaluation of people's awareness of the situation that can then help them to avoid accidents. And that's, I think that's quite an important issue in Malaysia, if I may say so.
Right. How long have you lived here? You've noticed that too, have you?
I have indeed.
Do we have enough psychologists in the world? Not just, you know, in Malaysia, but in the world?
Apparently not. And the reason why I say this is because psychology is becoming more and more popular. More and more students around the world, not just Malaysia, certainly growing in Malaysia, but around the world, more and more students are applying to do psychology. And the more students who apply to do psychology are effectively making psychology into a bigger profession, and they're actually creating demand for this kind of profession. So, for example, when I was a student at Liverpool University in the early 1980s, I was among a cohort of 60 students. There were 60 students in my year, but these days that would be such a small course in the UK. Typically you'd expect to see 200 or 250 students a year. Mm-hmm. And so in other words, that's how many are graduating each year of the 120 psychology degree course that run in the UK. And the more people who are graduating, the more demand that's being created for this profession. And of course there's more demand anyway, because people are beginning to recognise more widely the scope and the scale of psychological disorders and what psychologists can offer to companies and to the health service and to the public sector.
All right. You mentioned earlier, Peter, that you see mental health issues on the rise in Malaysia itself. Do you feel that the authorities and I suppose the medical profession are not taking it as seriously as they should?
I think you're absolutely right about that. They're not aware of the scale of the problem. And the reason why they're not aware of the scale is because families who have problems are inclined to feel embarrassed about it, like I was saying earlier, and try to hide the kids away or hide a family member away. And they do feel quite embarrassed about it. And for that reason, people with problems not being referred to professionals, and professionals therefore are not aware of it, so they don't understand, they're not aware of the scale of this problem. But as I said, it's very likely that there are 250,000 people in Malaysia who have autism. There's probably a large number of people who have clinical depression or schizophrenia, and these people are not recognized, they're not known about, they're not recognized by the system,
and they're suffering in silence too.
They're suffering in silence. And it's not very nice, and actually it's quite dangerous as well. So okay. The community needs to do something about that.
Okay, what are job prospects for a psychologist in Malaysia?
I think the job prospects in Malaysia are going to improve radically over the next few years for the reasons that I've already said.
Okay.
Because there's going to be a growing awareness of how psychologists can contribute to the community, how they can deal with this growing recognition of psychological disorders. But if you don't believe me, why don't you just take a look at job websites like jobstreet.com and put in the keyword psychologist, and you'll see lots and lots of jobs coming up on there.
Right. I have a question here from Lim, who wants to know what the role of a graduate in psychology would be in a corporation.
It depends on in what sense you mean. If you mean they're working as a professional psychologist, or if you mean it's somebody who has graduated in psychology and now they're working not necessarily as a psychologist, they just have a general role in that corporation.
Right.
And I think that question is what kind of skills would a psychologist have to offer to a corporation? The answer is that a psychologist is somebody who is highly expert in statistical analysis. So there's somebody who's going to be very, very good at making, for example, market predictions. There's somebody who is going to be very well practiced in presenting data, in presenting information. They'll have good presentational skills. There's somebody who is going to understand how to write technical reports. They're going to have ability in marketing, in advertising. So these are some of the skills that a psychologist would have. But, if you just think more generally about employees now who want to recruit graduates, for example, recently the Malaysian Air Force has announced that they're only going to accept graduates onto their pilot training program. Now, what better degree to do than mm-hmm. psychology if you want to be a pilot? And I say that with first-hand knowledge, being a pilot myself. I've recently joined the Royal Selangor Flying Club, and I have to do exams on psychology
right.
in order to gain a Malaysian flying license.
What are some of the questions on that exam that would,
The questions are about how you can misperceive the situation.
Right.
How does human perception work? How can you misperceive the situation? How can you miscalculate. So you need to be aware of your psychological limitations in order to be a good pilot. And most accidents in aviation are caused by human error. And human error means psychological miscalculations. That's what it means, really.
Okay. Now, you're also editor-in-chief of the British Journal of Psychology. What has that job taught you, Peter?
It's taught me about the terrific talent in psychology. Last year, we published Volume 100, celebrating more than 100 years of history of the journal. And for that issue, we published some, or reprinted some, classic articles. And it was a pleasure to see the quality of those and what they brought to the discipline. But more recently, we published target articles by, for example, Michael Tomasello, who's at the Max Planck Institute, who's comparing the ability to understand minds in human infants against the ability to understand minds in ape infants. You know, do humans have a better understanding of mind than apes? So the kind of talent that these people have is really quite stunning. And that's one of the things that it's taught me to be the editor of that journal, this wealth of talent that we have.
Okay. If a student who is considering, I suppose, their future course, you know, main major, what would you say to them as, you know, as someone who has been in this line for so many years, what would you say to, I suppose, convince them to consider a degree in psychology?
I would say psychology is the science of the future. You know, traditionally, science courses have been physics, chemistry, biology, and they're still very, very important. But the science of the future is psychology. And it's a discipline that's recognised now in the UK as part of the core science curriculum in secondary schools.
Wow.
Yeah, that's true. So this is the science of the future, especially if you adopt a technical approach, especially if what you're learning about is cognitive neuroscience. So, for example, in psychology, especially if you do a postgraduate degree in psychology, like, for example, some universities run a course in cognitive neuroscience and neuroimaging. On a course like that, you would be learning how to use an MRI scanner. You'd learn how to interpret the data. Now, in Malaysia, of course, more and more hospitals are acquiring devices like this, MRI scanners. And what's needed is technicians who can use the scanner, who can interpret the data and understand the psychological meaning of the data. So I would say to a parent, what you should look for your child is a course that's going to lead you into that kind of field, because that's the science of the future. That's where we're going to be in the future.
I thank you, Peter, for joining us today on The Bigger Picture.
It's my great pleasure. And actually, if I might just say, this is a terrific radio station. It's absolutely superb. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was Peter Mitchell, editor-in-chief of the British Journal of Psychology, on your potential future in psychology. This is The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station.